My guest today is Professor Thane Rosenbaum, who's professor of law at Touro University. He's also the director of the Forum on Life, Culture, and Society. He also serves as the legal analyst for CBS News Radio and frequently appears on cable television news programs. Welcome, Thane.
Thank you, Gil.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So I don't know much about these topics, Thane, so I don't know much about any topics for that matter.
That's not true. You got the word scientific right behind you.
So science and economics are closer to my level of ignorance, but this is a little bit further away from it. So I'm hoping to learn something from it. So we have sort of two buckets of topics. One is in the area of First Amendment, and I picked up something, as I mentioned, from Yale, from Judd Campbell. He says here in the abstract, the Supreme Court often claims that the First Amendment reflects an original judgment about the proper scope of expressive freedom. After a century of academic debate, however, the meanings of speech and press freedoms at the founding remain remarkably hazy. So that is quite remarkable. So there are two things here. One is, when we think about First Amendment, there are two separate things there, right? Which is free speech and free press.
Well, and also freedom of religion and freedom of assembly. All of those are the primary freedoms, but oftentimes an association. So freedom of religion is often treated alone. Freedom of speech is often combined with speech, freedom of expression, and then freedom of association and freedom of assembly are often treated the same.
Okay, so this freedom of press idea, how do we define? I mean, they didn't have press, did they, when they put this thing together?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Okay.
They felt, the founding fathers actually felt more strongly about press than speech. Speech was an afterthought. Press was seemingly more important to them. They ultimately added speech to the Bill of Rights later, before the Constitution was amended and ratified. So no, they always believed that a free press was essential. But speech had a different dimension to it because it fit into the concept of representative democracy, that you want people to participate. And the best way to participate is to give them the freedom to speak.
Yeah, so I remember you talking about sort of the marketplace of ideas, where if a large number of people come together, express different ideas, that's sort of an efficient market, from an economic perspective. But it doesn't quite work like that, right?
Yeah, it's funny. In my last book, Saving Free Speech from Itself, I talk about how we like to think of the marketplace of ideas the way economists think about marketplaces. But one of the things that I said in the book is that the rules of capitalism, the invisible hand of the market, means that if you make a better toothbrush, you will knock out all the other bad toothbrushes.
Right.
On the theory of, Adam Smith capitalism, that the idea of enter the marketplace and see how you do. It's a competitive marketplace. But there's a limitation to that in speech. It doesn't go as far as we think. For instance, if that was true, there wouldn't be Nazis. There shouldn't be Nazis. The Nazis were defeated in World War II. So why are they still with us? Those ideas had been roundly condemned. So, we like to think of this. Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of our most famous Supreme Court justices in Abrams versus the United States, introduced this idea of a marketplace. And since around over 100 years that we've had this idea of a marketplace, but I'm not sure that it's a marketplace that doesn't need some regulation because the marketplace on its own doesn't really work.
Yeah, so let's talk about regulation. So before we get there, so Do we have a definition for press? So what we are doing right now, would this be considered press in the grander notion?
What you and I are doing now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, anything that is a channel of communication that produces information. Remember, it's not as if the early publishers were neutral. Benjamin Franklin had his own newspaper, Alexander Hamilton had his own newspaper, and they shared those political philosophies. So yeah, it's true that, you know, people complain about how ideological some of the press media people are, but that was always true. Mm-hmm. But the key is, are there, in the economics term, are there barriers to entry, right?
Yeah.
The internet created fewer barriers to entry. You've got your own show,
and you're
out there. Without the internet, that was harder to do. Have your own newspaper, it's very hard to do. So yes, this definitely, podcasts definitely fall into the category of a certain freedom of press, so to speak, freedom of information.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So if the marginal cost of entry is declining, then are we sort of, so at some point, freedom of speech and freedom of press will be the same, right? I mean, you know, essentially I can go out right now and say anything I want. And if that is protected by freedom of press, but not by freedom of speech, I'm just making this up, but I don't know. So at some point, freedom of speech and freedom of press are aligned to be the same, right?
Well, unless you defame someone, if you defame someone who is not famous, newspapers, podcasts always are in danger of lawsuits. Freedom of speech is not unlimited. There are certain categories that are carved out that do not receive freedom of speech: obscenity, libel and defamation, biting words, true threats, the incitement of imminent lawlessness. Those are categories that are not protected under the First Amendment, and the press doesn't have a freedom there either. They can claim a freedom, but they can't harm people. The press can't be used to start a riot. You couldn't put out something that says, let's all go out and attack Jews and say, yes, I have a freedom. No, you don't. You actually don't. If people acted on your encouragement, that is not protected speech.
Right. So is that sort of defined that way in the Constitution? So what did the founders think about these types of things, or they sort of stumbled into it?
Until the 1960s, freedom of speech, I mean, it's a very short amendment, the First Amendment. It just says, Congress shall make no law to prohibit, restrict speech. Freedom of the press means that the government can't stand in your way to speak. But until the 1960s, lots of things were restricted. The Constitution was opened up around the 1960s, where a lot of things, search and seizure, what can happen with the police when they come to your door. Lots of areas of the Constitution were opened up, and one of them was speech, which all of a sudden, things that we would not have imagined to be protected became protected. Things that we called, you know, anti-war, you know, prior to the 1960s could have been illegal. But nowadays, people can take political positions in surprising ways. So for instance, our country, unlike Western European nations that are also democracies, many of which also have freedom of speech, they do not allow Nazis. Nazi ideology is banned in a number of West European countries. Hate speech is completely prohibited in many of the Western European countries, but not in the United States. There's no law against hate speech in the United States. We are much more permissive than most of the other Western democracies. So, you know, in our country, it's still legal to burn a cross on the lawn of an African American as a symbol of speech. I think it's ridiculous, and I've written against it, but it's still the law of the land.
So what caused it? What caused us to become go in that direction? So you mentioned 1960s. So did anything dramatic happen in the 60s that allowed us?
It was a revolutionary period. It began a whole era of, pro-gay movement, pro-women's movement, civil rights, right? The struggle for civil rights for African Americans opened up a lot of other rights. So the Bill of Rights were really opened up significantly in the 1960s, and freedom of speech especially was opened up.
Yeah, so to make a revolution, you have to have freedom of speech in some sense. Otherwise, you will be you won't be allowed to do that based on the status quo principles. And so that is what happened to us in the 60s. We opened up, as you say, all these ideas, all these rights, and we are in a much more advanced state. Well, I'm making a speculation here. People could object to it. But now we probably need some regulation, right? I mean, I'm just speculating here. So what did you mean by regulation of speech?
Well, look, I mean, I can give you some examples of what constitutes free speech that one could wonder, really? Like, for instance, we've learned that the burning of the American flag, there's free speech. you can protest at the military, at the funeral of military soldiers that were killed in action with signs that read, "God hates fags," to protest that homosexuals can serve in the military. The Supreme Court ruled 8-1 over the rights of the father to bury his son in peace, that the group that was objecting to gays serving in the military had greater rights than the father did to bury his son. I think that's crazy, but that just shows you how permissive the United States is. So the question then becomes, what is it that the Europeans know that we don't? And what they know is something called dignity, human dignity, which does not exist in the Declaration of Independence. It's not in the Constitution. It's not mentioned. So, for instance, the French Constitution, the German Constitution, the words dignity appear constantly, constantly. And it just shows that for them, to humiliate another human being, to deprive them of their rights of citizenship, which is to have equal standing in the world, equal standing just with everyone else, is so significant that those rights should be protected over the speech rights of someone who wants to say something that is not violent, but in audio terms is violent. It's a harmful act. Again, not an offensive act. Offense is different. Insults are different. I don't think you have a right to be protected from insults or offense, but I think you should be protected from harm. And speech can cause harm. And all the neuroscience, the recent neuroscience, evidence is clear that harms on dignity, harms that are caused are not just psychological. They have physiological components. They lead to inflammation and cause sickness. Again, we don't recognize that in the United States, but we could. We have the science to back it up, but we could.
Yeah, so if I understand this correctly, Thane, so American Constitution is more pure in the sense that, it's setting out a set of principles, scientific principles. A term like dignity, for example, it's very, very difficult to define it because it needs a context, it needs a person you're attaching it to. There's a lot of uncertainty around it. So from a principled perspective, if I understand this correctly, American Constitution is taking more of a scientific view to what they mean by free speech.
Well, I'm not saying that anyone agrees with what I'm saying. most people in who are law professors or First Amendment scholars think that the European model is wrong. That more, you know, there's another Supreme Court justice, you know, between Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes, there's this other idea that, you know, the more speech cancels out bad speech. And the more light you put on a subject, the more it disinfects the area. Yeah. And I'm just not so sure. I'm not sure that the more you flood the market with bad ideas, today's a really good example because of the internet. You could see the protests on campus. Almost all those students have no idea about the history of the Middle East, not the slightest idea. They can't tell you any of these countries on a map. They have no idea how Israel became a country. They don't know anything. But they are watching TikTok, and that's where they're learning their news.
So if yeah, we don't teach history. We don't teach history in this country.
So if you're asking me, I think that what we've seen the last number of months is a very good example of what I'm talking about. Mm. Here, more speech is not better. It's worse because there's no moderator. Nobody's saying this is a primary source and this is nonsense. This is from China and it's there to instigate trouble. And these are primary sources. They don't know. So I'm not so sure that we don't need more barriers to entry, gatekeepers in the economic sense. Because
it's also, wouldn't you say it's also a lack of debate in the sense that, you know, I don't know, maybe 400-500 years ago, a debate used to mean that you take the opponent's ideas and you sort of scientifically and mathematically show why something could be wrong. You know, it's truly a debate format. And it seems like we have lost that talent. So right now we only have shouting matches. We have shouting matches between two groups. That's all we have. And as you say, neither of these groups actually know what the heck is going on.
Yeah.
And they don't spend any time really thinking about it, which is the saddest thing. I mean, these are great universities. I mean, education has been our sort of a primary export mechanism in the U.S. And when we see this type of stuff in university campuses, I think it's devalues the U.S. more programmatically, I would say.
But to me, that's not a First Amendment problem or free speech problem. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be a liberal and what liberal education means. We no longer have liberal education. So when you go to college and you say, I'm studying the liberal arts, that's a fallacy or not anymore, not in the United States. Liberal arts means I'm open. I'm open for business. All ideas are something I'm ready to hear. I'm calm. I don't start screaming at people. I listen and I go, you know, I never thought about it that way. Let me give it some thought. I'll get back to you, or maybe I won't get back to you. But thank you for that perspective. Yeah. Today, if you offer a perspective people don't like, they shot you down. They yell at you, they scream at you, they call you names, they won't let you speak. That's the failure of the university. It's not a free speech problem. It's a failure of liberalism. It's that we decided that instead of teaching you how to think, universities now have to teach you what you must think. What you must think. And if you don't think that, you're morally beyond the pale. Right. You should not live. You should die. You should be sent away. But it's true. This is what people say. You should not live. And this, to me, how university presidents allowed that is shocking. Shocking.
Yeah.
Partly their fault, because they believe that too. They believe that you should die. If you don't believe, so there's no academic freedom. The freedom is, you are free to think the way I think. If you don't think the way I think, you have no freedom. So I just think that is a failure of liberalism in America and certainly on campuses, that they don't understand what it means to be a liberal is not what it means to be a progressive. Liberals are not ideologues. Liberals are open. They're calm. They're deliberate in their thinking. They're rational in their analysis. They're able to reflect and deliberate. That's what the Enlightenment of the 18th century was designed to do.
Mm.
Open your mind, not close your mind, open your mind. So, you know, to me, yeah, it sounds like a free speech problem because we're not allowed to engage in meaningful debate, but it's partly because we don't understand what liberal education means.
Yeah, and so do you think there's a difference between the coast, the East Coast and the West Coast and the Midwest? The reason I'm asking is that I went to school at Northwestern at University of Chicago. Those schools seem to have done little better with the recent turbulence that we have gone through. Do you think there is a cultural distinction?
Not sure. The last few weeks, Chicago and Northwestern, both late. They're late. I agree. They're late to the party, but they're there. They're definitely there. Northwestern was acceding to the demands of the movement. They wanted to avoid the protests, so they were, you know, seriously negotiating. You don't negotiate with students. The students don't own the school. Kick them out. They don't belong. If you're demanding where the university invests its money and how people should treat Jews on campus, then you don't belong in a college. You don't understand what it means to be in higher education. And they should be all expelled. We're not shouldn't be negotiated, but you know, we have capitulated to a mob of illiberal, anti-intellectual, ahistorical bullies. Mm. They're bullies. And so, yeah, so, you know, I don't know if I agree that the coastal elites are usually worst on progressive politics. You know, Los Angeles, New York, I agree. But you're seeing it everywhere. You're seeing it in the South. Yeah. You're seeing it, you know, you're seeing it everywhere. You're seeing less of it. That's true, but you're still seeing it.
So in some sense, this is a problem of emotions, right? So as you say, the people who are protesting, do they really understand what they are protesting? It's sort of the first question. And even if they understand it, then the secondary question would be, what would be sort of the most optimum way to counteract whatever they think is bad? Right. So, you know, is it by burning buildings and all that stuff? Most often not. Right. So what we are missing is sort of a rational analysis of what is wrong and how to tackle the wrong. Both of those things appear to be missing in this context.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, what should happen, I think, is university presidents and a few professors from certain departments should host a session where it's on the record. Here are the facts. This is what a genocide is. This is not a genocide. This is how Israel came into being. It's not a colonialist nation, right? Now, if you want to listen to the president and the other scholars who know this and ignore them, you can pretend that it's a genocide, but you can't shut down facilities. You can't bully students. You can't sleep overnight on campus on the green, right? Yeah. You could be an imbecile if you want. You have the right to be stupid and ignorant and to even hate someone if you want to, but not if it affects those students that are there. You can hate them, but if you're going to be a disruptive presence on campus through your hatred, you have to leave. You're gone. We don't want you here. This is not a conducive learning environment for a moron who insists on bullying other students. So that's what should happen. Instead, the humanities programs in the United States are so anti-Semitic and filled with a lot of true mediocre people, people that were largely hired but for diversity reasons or inclusion. They're not hired on merit. They're clowns. They were hired for all the wrong reasons. Noble reasons at first, arguably, but ultimately the wrong reasons. They don't belong in a university setting. They shouldn't be teaching anything anywhere. So what happened is they became the majority in the humanities departments, and the university presidents are scared of them. Why? Because the faculty senates can hold a no confidence vote and remove a president faster than the trustees. so that the hot university presidents are more scared of the faculty than they are of the people that provide the money, because a no confidence vote means that they're out. And so they're spending a lot of time placating and capitulating to nonsense because they're afraid, or they are themselves ignorant and anti-Semitic, and they like what they hear. And so they happen to be head of a university that's an anti-Semitic university.
But that's an opinion, right, Thane? So, you know, I appreciate where you're coming from. Going back to the First Amendment question, anybody has a right to express their opinions. And if I understand this correctly, there are some constraints on that. You know, I can go out and shout. You know, the famous example is you cannot shout fire in a theater where there is no fire.
No, it has to be a crowded theater.
A crowded theater.
You can go to any theater, and if it's empty, and say anything you want.
Right. Yeah. And so there has to be some constraints on that. But anybody, so the spirit of the First Amendment, if I understand this correctly, is that you have the right to express your opinions.
Sure.
But there are some constraints around that. Yeah.
Well, there are, again, regulatory things that are already here. Again, university presidents are afraid to use them. There are content-based restrictions that are called, they're not content-based, they're called content neutral, meaning we're not stopping you for speaking for what you're saying. We're stopping you for some other reason. So for instance, time, place, and manner restrictions. We don't care where you say, but we don't let you say it in this place or at this time, right? Time, place, and manner, or the way you say it, screaming it in a way that is disruptive, that's restrictions that are permissible. They're neutral. They're not based on what you say. It's how you said it and where you said it and the times in which you said it. So university presidents could absolutely say, we're imposing time, manner, and place restrictions. You cannot stay overnight. You can't shout at students and intimidate them. Time, place, and manner. We're not the concept. You have the right to be an imbecile, but not in the way you choose to be an imbecile. That we can restrict.
Yeah, I'm a bit nervous about that, Thane, without knowing anything about it. So if you become prescriptive, time, place, and manner, as you say, it then goes back to the person who is defining those things, because there are no standard definitions.
But you can always challenge that, Gil. You can always go to a court and say, these time, place, manner restrictions are improper. They're an excuse to ultimately restrict the content. You're claiming you're claiming to be content neutral. You're not content neutral. You're content focused, and you're making an excuse based on time, place, and manner restrictions. In other words, you can test the rule and say, what you're really trying to do is restrict my speech, and that I won't let you do.
Right. Yeah, so I want to go into another topic. It's an equally fascinating topic, and I picked up something from another university. So I picked up a review article on this thing. So Revenge, a Multi-Level Review and Synthesis from University of North Carolina and University of Maryland. So here they say in the abstract, why do people take revenge? The question can be difficult to answer.
What question is that?
Why do people take revenge?
Revenge, right, okay.
This question can be difficult to answer, they say. Vengeance seems interpersonally destructive and antithetical to many of the basic human instincts. However, an emerging body of social scientific research has begun to illustrate a logic to revenge, demonstrating why revenge evolved in humans and when and how people take revenge. So as I read through this, you know, as I skimmed through this, they're arguing that there are two types of things, and you're interested in this also. So the neuroscience aspect to it, that, you know, we can think about evolution. You know, there was an evolutionary advantage to revenge. And then more recently, a sort of a cultural and societal aspect to it. Punishment might have optimized society in some way. So where do you come out on this?
Well, you know, I've written a book about revenge, Payback, the Case for Revenge. And I think that one, what I consider to be an illusion is the idea that revenge and justice are different. I think they're exactly the same. So we've always said, oh, no, I'm not interested in revenge. I'm only interested in justice. That's not true. You are interested in revenge. You're interested in both. The neuroscience, the evolutionary biology, as you've described, the evolutionary psychology, pretty clear. Human beings are hardwired for justice and fairness. Mm. If you and I are playing a game of cards and one of your children or a neighbor comes by and watches us and they see that you cheat, they're not going to like it. They may not point it out. Even if it doesn't affect them, they don't like it. That's why when people go to revenge movies, what do they care? They can't leave the theater until the bad guy, the wrongdoer, gets what's due. It's owed to him. They're not going anywhere. So if revenge is so bad, why are revenge movies so popular? And why don't people leave in the middle of them? This is disgusting. It's not disgusting. They must see that the wrongdoer, that payback was paid. Yeah. The wrongdoer received what was owed. That it was done measure for measure, all the terms, the mathematical terms of moral balance. You took advantage of me, you're here, I'm here, I have to come here. If I go here, then you're gonna wanna go higher. That's the difference, the concept of proportionate revenge. If it's disproportionate revenge, then you keep going up again. So the idea is, how do you get to equal measure for measure? I always say revenge needs to be taken by accountants, CPAs, to know the exact number. That's right. So we're hardwired for justice and vengeance. We need to know that justice was done. And so one of the things that I point out in the book about revenge art, films, novels, plays, they all share one thing in common, which is that the legal system was given the chance to do the right thing and didn't. And then the avenger now has the moral authority to do what he needs to do. It's as if to say, we'll give the government a chance, because remember, what started with the ancient Greeks was the concept of, we will not allow this to be done through individuals and families and tribes, but the government will take over. We will have a legal system, a justice system, and we'll take revenge out of the hands of what's called self-help, my own right to get. The problem is that the legal system has bad hands, and it doesn't do it sometimes. And when it doesn't do it, it creates this hole, a moral hole, that victims can't experience. They can't tolerate it. It's intolerable. And so that's why it's important for the legal system to get it right, because there was once the rights of man, and the rights of man was replaced by the rule of law. Okay. Fine. I pay my tax dollars. You want to do it? Hire the police, hire prosecutors, judges. I get it. But then you got to do it. Because if you don't do it, you can't be mad that I do it. And that's sort of the interesting thing. Now, people would say from my book, he's in favor of vigilante justice. No, I'm not in favor, but I understand it. I can totally understand it. And I gave a lot of examples in the book where people tend to be in favor of vigilante justice when the other result is intolerable, intolerable to see someone get away with it.
So do you think our judicial system is fair and really designed to take care of this problem, or have you gone far left or far right on that?
Yeah, it does it poorly. And one of the reasons you could argue is because we don't have enough resources. But 98% of all cases, civil and criminal, never go to trial. So all the TV shows about trials, they don't happen. Yeah. Everything is in criminal case subject to a plea bargain, and in civil cases subject to a settlement. What does that mean? The victims never get their day in court. They never get to go to court, and they never say, this is what happened to me. I need a public acknowledgement what happened to me. I need a judgment against him or her for what he or she did to me. And instead, you get a settlement where you're dividing it in half. There's no record of what happened. Usually in civil cases, as subject to the settlement, you're not allowed to speak about it again. So someone says, in exchange for this money, I don't want to hear from you that you spoke badly about me. You're not allowed to. But that's the whole point, that the person needs to feel vindicated. And I'm not sure that a check is vindication. So we've created, similarly in the criminal area, we plea bargain murder down to involuntary murder, you know, reckless endangerment. So the person goes to jail, not from what they did, but for what they pleaded guilty to that's lower. So the official record is not what they did. It's something less. And they spend less time in jail. So if that's the way the legal system resolves these senses of grievances, it doesn't do a very good job, because it leaves people ultimately unhappy because they did not feel justice was done.
So I'm stuck on the 98% thing. So if it were not like that, we will bring that legal system to its knees, right?
Yeah. Well, you'd need more courthouses and more judges, and you'd need other ways, mechanisms, to not dispose of cases so quickly. It's the I've written about this in two different books. It's the speed with which we try to dispose of the case that creates a lot of additional harm. That it just simply just makes it disappear. And we don't do anything really to give victims a sense of vindication.
So I want to get your perspective on this. You know, we have many cases going through the Supreme Court nowadays, and it appears that the Supreme Court is turning back the appeals court decisions. You know, whoever is, I don't know how the legal system works, but things go through the system and it gets to Washington, and then they say, well, all those guys who made other decisions are all wrong. Us eight or seven, or I don't know how many are there.
Nine. In the Supreme Court, nine.
And we know so much better than all those guys, and we're going to turn it back. Is that a good system?
Well, you know, we have a system here based on the English system of common law and stare decisis, that court precedents, case precedents, you follow the precedents. But sometimes bad laws get overturned. So, for instance, there was once Plessy versus Ferguson, which was for many years the law of the land, that was something called separate but equal, that we can separate the races but try to make them equal. They were never equal. So Brown versus Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson and integrated the school systems. It's what essentially created a true, you know, experience of a cohesion in America by bringing the races together. So, you know, there are bad laws. I'm sure there are people who were anti-abortion, who think that what the Supreme Court did a few years ago in Dobbs' case did the right thing, and that the Supreme Court should have the right to overturn precedents that in later times we see as being incorrect. Again, there's enormous public debate about that, but it does allow for a certain flexibility that doesn't exist in many countries. The flexibility of, you know, giving the court an opportunity to look at it through fresh eyes, through fresh understanding, sociology, economics, bring to bear new disciplines, apply new theories, and say, you know what, we're looking at it now, I think we were wrong, and we should overturn it. We should give it another look. So I think that our system in that way creates more opportunity for fixing bad results. And again, remember, laws are created by legislatures and they're evaluated by courts. So it never stops the legislatures from legislating their own. You know, Joe Biden promised to have a federal amendment to grant abortion rights. He could have tried that in order to respond to what the Supreme Court did in Dobbs. He could have said, let's make it a federal right. The Supreme Court says it's not constitutional. Okay, fine. It goes back to the states, let the states decide it's a private moral matter. But Biden could have said, well, why don't we just make it, you know, let's make enshrine it as its own right that isn't implied in the Constitution, but is expressed as its own amendment.
Yeah, so I don't know much about the law arena, but it is interpretations. So these are not scientific laws. You know, it's not theory of relativity or Newton's laws of motion. These are interpretations. So that is, by definition, is interpretation of few people, right? So I cannot prove something is wrong or right by scientific principles.
Right.
So essentially, there's a hierarchy of things that we put together. At the top of the pyramid, there are nine people who say, hey, we know everything about everything. But it looks like they know almost nothing from my perspective.
Well, remember, for the first 150 years, the Supreme Court oftentimes, whatever the number, sometimes there were seven justices, I think there was five at one point, but they used to be unanimous. 9-0, 7-0. It's
not
only
anymore.
Five to four, 5-4, 5-6-3. So it's better for the country to think that the Supreme Court knows the law and has agreement on the law. But that what you're describing has a lot to do with ideological understandings of the Constitution. There are six conservative justices and three progressive or liberal justices. And it's often the case that they vote 6-3. Yeah. So it's not that they know everything. It's just six of them as a block see it this way. And this three see it that way. And that's why, you know, President Trump was not wrong when he said, the most important thing I did was put three justices on the court, because that was a lot. You know, presidents that never put anybody on the court.
Yeah.
He put one third of the court in 4 years. That was extraordinary. Right. Obama had two in 8 years. So, you know, just to give you a perspective, Clinton, two in 8 years. He had three in four. Had he won election, he would have had another one when Breyer stepped down. He would have had four. So, you know, a lot of it is when people say the Supreme Court hates this, the accusation that it's political, but it's hard to deny that the president that appoints you largely gets what he wants. Now, that doesn't mean there haven't been disappointments. Sandra Day O'Connor would have been a definite disappointment to President Reagan. Justice Souter would have been a disappointment to George H. Bush. Justice Kennedy would have been a disappointment to Reagan. Some of the justices end up being different from what they started out, but for the most part, they embody the values of the president who selected them.
So I want to touch on another topic. I don't know if this is part of your research thing, but so I grew up as a Catholic in South India. And when I turned 12, I said, religion is a bane of humanity. So I left. And I came to believe that religion, whenever you see religion, trouble follows. And all the data that I have seems to say that. So we have a big election going on in India, as you know.
Yeah.
1.4 billion people. The guy in charge appears to want to make the quote-unquote democracy a theocracy. And I think that would be problematic for the future. So what is your thinking around religion You know, so suppose we have a world of 8 billion people and we have no religion. Do you think we would be better off?
Well, let me just say, when we started off with the First Amendment, freedom of religion meant what it says, which is that we do not, there's two different ways of seeing it. We have the freedom of religion, and there's something called the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which means the government doesn't have the right to establish a religion. What does that mean? Yeah. It doesn't have the right to tell you what religion to practice. It doesn't have the right to favor one religion over another religion. So those are two different kinds of First Amendment violations. Stopping people from religion and promoting a religion. Establish. The country is supposed to be neutral, right? Like the French is even different. The French democracy hates religion. We don't technically, the French religion, their understanding is they are very anti-religious as part of their democracy. We're not. We just say you have the freedom. My experience is religion is only a problem when it's extremist.
Yeah.
When you have, you know, strict adherence to Sharia law. Strict adherence to Sharia law means beheadings, means dismemberments, means lashings, means stoning. You know, when I hear that the Pew surveys go throughout North Africa, the Persian Gulf, Middle East, and in many countries, most people, somewhere between 50 to 70% of the people, believe in a strict adherence to Sharia law, that's very scary to me. So I'm not worried about religion. I'm worried about the extremism in religion. That when we see the problems from the Crusades on, from the, you know, from the Inquisition on, from the various things that force people to believe what is not what I you know, if you apply the First Amendment properly, I think it's beautiful. Give people a chance to believe in whatever they want. If they need to believe in a higher power to make the day better for them, that's great. Some people believe in Shakespeare. Some people believe in God. You know, some people believe in Einstein, in science. They learn, to them, what grounds them on the planet is their knowledge of science. That's great. I love that. But there are people for whom their anchor is a higher power. And I'm not going to tell them not to, but if they're going to demand that I dress a certain way and eat a certain way and talk a certain way. You know, we really have a problem, and I've written about, you know, Islam is a problem. It's a problem. To pretend that it's not, it's a joke. It's a problem. The fact that what happened with the Danish cartoons, the French cartoons, the killings all in the name of Muhammad and Allah, that's a problem. And so, unfortunately, unlike many of the other world religions, there's been no reformist movement within Islam. It's a problem. Yeah. Catholicism has it. Judaism has it. That's why it's wrong to pretend I don't want to insult Muslims. I'm happy to insult Muslims right now. There's something wrong with what's going on there. You need to open. You need to open this up, because without opening up, look what's being done in the name of your God, and these are crimes against humanity, and that if you know it's time. This is the 21st century. I know you're in love with the 13th century, but you shouldn't be. You should really embrace the moment in which you're in, and find a way to the people that are most in danger are reformist Muslims. They get killed. Nobody who's
a reformist. I'm sort of looking at it empirically then. So if I have democracy on the y-axis, and I have agnosticism on the x-axis, there's a very strong relationship between democracy and agnosticism, I would argue. I cite Scandinavia, I cite Denmark, New Zealand, Japan. And on the other side of the equation, I cite places like India. U.S. is actually getting there too now.
I get it.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that you know, I think it's for many people, because we were given a big brain, which is what is different from the other species on the planet. The big brain is a liability. And the liability is there's a lot of extra thinking that goes in, and all that thinking and worrying is for many people, the neuroses, you know, is very dangerous, and yeah. they need ways to steady themselves. And if religion right. is a way to steady yourself, far be it from me to say, look, but it's ultimately bad, because look around the world, you have these anti-democratic, illiberal countries, authoritarian countries, and guess what they all have in common? Religion.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what Gill said, and Gill is right. Look at the chart, look at the axis, he's right. Yeah, I get it. But, you know, I just think that they're one of the reasons the divide in our country, it's a very large country. So red states and blue states, religion has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, the red states believe in God and believe in God in a very different way from the people that live in Los Angeles and New York. And I don't feel confident or credible enough to tell people in Kansas how they should spend their days.
Yes.
That's the problem I see politically. The yeah. blue state elitism is dismissive of red states. Very dismissive, and they think they're a bunch of stupid rubes. And I don't believe that. I don't believe it. I wouldn't say it. And one of the reasons if you don't like Donald Trump, it's your fault. It's your fault for the way you treat the other states.
Yeah.
Your treatment of the other states, you're dismissed. When Hillary Clinton used the word deplorables, I knew Donald Trump would win. I went, oh my God. I mean, I'm a registered Democrat. When I heard the word deplorables, I thought, God, how could you vote for someone? Can you vote for someone who spoke to half the country as deplorables? Why? Because they didn't go to Yale? Really? That's the reason? Because they don't have your privileged life? Really? Because they're on a farm? Really? That's the reason? Because they haven't read as many books as you? That's the reason? But that is a real problem in America. The divide between blue problem. And red has a lot to do, and has a lot to do with God as well. It also has a lot to do with patriotism. You know, the red states, what they're looking at when they see these universities on the East Coast with the burning of the flags and bringing down the American flag and putting up the Palestinian flag, I can't imagine what they're thinking. Generations of people that fought for the flag, relatives died for the flag, and a bunch of foreigners, many of them are students on student visas, are pulling down the American flag. They should be deported immediately, yesterday. They shouldn't be here. You should not be on a student visa and pulling down the American flag. You should be kissing every building. And if you're not kissing every building, you got to go. It's okay. Nothing personal. Yeah, just get out.
I think, you know, so the larger principle I would say is that if you go to a country from another, then you are sort of, you know, expected to assimilate with that country's ideas and culture and everything else. Otherwise, don't go would be the right prescription, right? So
Were you referring to like what also happened in Europe with no-go zones in Paris, you know, that, you know, I think that's what you're saying, because I've written about this. I mean, I do think if you live in Madrid, Stockholm, Paris, London, Brussels, Berlin, there's a lot of buyer's remorse to say, you know, unless you believe in liberalism in general and a sense of pluralism in general, understanding, you know, of democratic principles, you're not going to like it here.
Right.
You're not going to like it. You're not going to like it, and we're not going to like the outcome. And so you've really got to ask yourself, and we have to ask you, are you okay with the movies we show? Are you okay with the books that we produce? Because if you have any problem with it, this isn't for you. Nothing personal. It won't be good for social cohesion if you're in a country grinding your teeth down because we allow nudity in movies.
So in an ironic way, Thane, you know, as the economics of the world improve, I mean, we had a lot of immigration. You know, I came here in the mid 80s to go to graduate school.
You came on a student visa and you stayed.
I'm sorry?
You came on a student visa and
stayed. Yeah, yeah.
And became a citizen.
And so increasingly, there is less of a need for that because, you know, all these countries are economically improving.
Yeah.
So perhaps in the long run, we may have less of a problem. I mean, countries have its own culture, its own beliefs, its own constitution. its own ideas, and it's a self-selection mechanism, but it used to be that we selected into another country for economic reasons, right? But you never let go of your ideas or whatever, you know, from the country that you came from. So that has been a problem. So hopefully, I'm just thinking forward. Hopefully this will be less of a problem in the future, I'm thinking.
Well, but the problem was, I think that you're going to see this in this election. If you were a computer scientist from Finland or Sweden or Norway, good luck coming here. But if you were coming through the southern border, you walked right in.
No, they wouldn't come here. There's no Finland computer scientist coming to the U.S. anymore.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, that's what Americans are seeing, you know, that this became... It's one thing to seek asylum. We're not even sure the people are asylum seekers. They're just coming. And that is new. That was never true in this country. We have literally opened the border. And we'll see in the next 10 years what the consequences of that are. I'm told there are 11 million people. That's, I guess, 4% of the country right now is here illegally. There's 330 million. 11 million are illegal. I don't know, is that 4%? That's a lot of people that they're not here legally. And that is, it's a shocking number. And apparently 5 of that million is just in the last 3 years. So we're going to face very soon whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. You know, we'll see.
I know you have to go, but Thane, so I'm not entering politics anytime soon, but my policy would be to have open borders. So we have 200 countries, and I don't see the need for countries anymore. So I'm a total globalist.
I love that. No countries, no religions.
No countries, no religions would be my policy.
Very simple. Nice and clean. No borders, no religions, just live your life. The problem really is it's a problem of humanity.
Yeah.
That we don't really respect each other's lives to live it the way we want. We're very demanding. You have to believe this way. You have to live this way. You have to show me this. If people could do what you're saying, there would not be a need for countries. There wouldn't be a need for religion.
But the good thing is I won't be getting elected anytime soon, so nobody has to worry about it.
Yeah, but you might have gotten my vote. Don't cancel yourself out. There's people like me who would be very sympathetic to a candidate like you.
Excellent. So I know that you have something very close to it. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with me, Thane.
I hope that was fun. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks, Gil. Good program. Thank you.